There are a few devotees here from Jaipur who can't follow in English very well. Someone can translate. You're busy here, are you? Otherwise you could... Stoker Krishna. Is it already arranged? Okay. If you had a printout, that would be more helpful. But it's maybe on the phone or something like that. I only roughly follow the printout usually, unless I'm reading. Yeah, this will be rough. Only right. It may not help the printout actually. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Sri Vishnu Sahasranam, name 787, is Durariha. It's one of those names which is not common as a name. Some of the names in Vishnu Sahasranam are common as names, names like Krishna, Vishnu, these are well known as, and some of them are very easy to understand, names like Durlab, which is also a fairly common name in Bengal, Durlab. I think not in the Hindi-speaking areas, only maybe in Bengal. It's quite a common voice. Durlab, Durgam, Durga, these are just the recent names. And then Duravas was the last name. And then we have Durariha, which is not so easy, but not so difficult to understand. Dur, again, means difficult. Ari, if you know from Bhagavad Gita, Arisudana, Ari, Murari, this Ari means enemy. And Ha means killer. So it's the killer of difficult enemies is one way of interpreting it. And we'll see how the different commentators explain this name in various ways. Parashara Bhatta explains this name 787 all the way through to 810. He explains all these names in terms of Buddha avatar. You look a little surprised because Buddha was ahimsa paramo dharma, non-violence. Ahimsa is usually translated as non-violence. Non-violence is the topmost dharma. This was the famous saying of Lord Buddha. And then this name is the killer of the difficult enemies. Or ha can also mean destroying. So how do we get Lord Buddha here? Durari, Satyadeva Vashishtha explains as mean one who causes pain and misery from all sides. Translating dukkha, dur deriving from dukkha. So then the one who destroys all kinds of pain from all sides. Anyway, Parashara Bhatta, he says that Lord Vishnu, as the dispeller or the subduer of evil-minded enemies, one way he does it, he doesn't always kill them. One way he does it is to make them weak by turning away from the Vedas. And that was what Lord Buddha did. We know from Dashavatara Stotram, Nindasi Yagya Vidhe Ahaha Shruti Jatam Sadaya Hridaya Darshita Pashu Ghatam Keshava Dhritta Buddha Sharira Jaya Jagadisha Hare. He, although an avatar of the Supreme Lord, from whom Veda Narayana Sakshat, the Vedas emanate from Narayana, and all the Vedas, Vedaischa Sarvera Hameva Vedyaha, all the Vedas are meant for knowing Krishna. But this avatar, a very unusual avatar, decries the Vedas. Or rather, he decries Nindasi Yajna Vidher Ahaha Shrutija. He decries the performance of animal sacrifices, which are in accord with the Vedas. Why does he do that? Being very merciful, Sadaya Hrida, in his heart very merciful upon the animals that were being killed. So he decries the Vedas. But another reason that's given for him doing this, this is given here, Parashurabhata quotes from the Vishnu Purana in this regard, Mayamo hena te daitya prakarai bahubir sada vyuta pita yata naisham chayim kaschit arochayat hatascha te sura devai sanmarga paripantina. By his illusory potency, he, Lord Vishnu, confounded their minds in several ways and led them away from the path of the Vedas, as a result of which so many people became inimical to the Vedas. They became totally averse to going on the right path, and they were easily disposed of by the gods. And we have in Srimad Bhagavatam, Tatakalo Sampravritte Sammohaya Suradvisham Buddho Namnanjana Sutta Kika Teshu Bhavishyati. In the beginning of Kali Yuga, the Lord will appear as Lord Buddha, the son of Anjana, in the province of Gaya, just for the purpose of deluding those who are envious of the faithful theists. Now, how is all this to be understood? One thing is that by following the Vedas and the Vedic path, one gets power. And we see that even the evil-minded people get power by following the Vedic path. Bali Maharaj was able to conquer over the demigods when the demigods became weak due to Indra having insulted Brihaspati and Brihaspati abandoning Indra. And understanding this, Shukra, the guru of the demons, engaged them in performing various sacrifices by which they get power. By following the Vedic path, they get power. Ravana became very powerful by following the Vedic path and doing yajnas. And his son, Indrajit. The Vedas, by following, one becomes powerful. The Mayavadis, they strictly follow the Vedic path, not for the proper reason, but they follow all by vibrating the sounds. Actually, if we study the Vedas, with both the Vaishnavas and the Shankarites, they may be Rigvedis or Yajurvedis. They memorize the same Veda and they get power by doing so. And it's how it's understood and interpreted is something else. But by chanting the Vedas, that has a very powerful effect. The Chandrasekhar Indran, the Paramacharya at Kanchi, in the two generations previously, he was very insistent on this point. If the Brahmanas chant the Vedas, that will bring all auspiciousness. Of course, in the present age, the Brahmanas don't have that potency. Still, some potency may be there, but not to the extent that it was before. But it's a fact. People don't believe it when they hear such things, but we hear of Brahmanas, they chant mantras, and then demons, Twashta made the yajna from which the great demon Vitrasura came out of the yajna by his power. Vishvamitra, he started creating a whole universe, a new universe, by the power that he got from following the Vedic path. And there is a whole, we were just discussing that yesterday, there's a whole group of followers of the Vedas who do so to get material power, the power to go to the heavenly planets, those who follow the Purva Mimamsa, which is sometimes just called Mimamsa, and they're called Mimamsakas. And they get the power to do so by following the Vedic path. Kangshanta karmanam siddhim yajanta iha devataha. One quickly gets the result if one worships the demigods, which means performing yajnas by the Vedic path. So it is powerful and it is effective and it can be misused. The Atharva Veda is full of all kinds of things which are meant for destroying enemies, and it doesn't sound very good at all. It's something like black magic, you could say. So it can be, the Vedic path can be misused. This morning we read a verse in praise of Prithu Maharaj, who was performing sacrifices. Just in Vellore, we were reading from the Ramayana about how the Ashvamedha Yajna was performed, and Kaushalya with three strokes of the sword cut off the head of the horse, and then after that there was the Putreshti Yajna, by which the sons were born. It was that powerful. It could be done. There was such power in it. It can be used and it can be misused. And at the time of Lord Buddha, that was being misused for the sake of killing animals. And there are other, just killing animals wantonly. Prithu Maharaj was also doing, Dasharath Maharaj was also doing, but they were Vaishnavas and they were not doing for any harmful purpose. But in this present day of Brahma, the Brahmanas, they were performing just not out of any good motive. They were under the cover of the Vedas. They were killing so many animals, and we find in the second canto of Bhagavatam it's described about Buddha in another age how he also his purpose is to delude the demons from their, who are doing all kinds of wizardry or black magic using the Vedic path. Now we're going to, in all these names of Vishnu Sahasranam, we're going to discuss Buddha, and I'm going to try and restrain myself from getting into a whole big thing about Buddhism, because it's a huge culture and all the stories of the Bodhisattvas, and it's a huge, and so much philosophy came out of it. It's amazing, profuse philosophy, much of which is lost. They must have a lot of philosophy because it's very hard to explain the basic premise, which is not even you can't even begin to get your mind around the basic premise, which is that actually there is nothing. Well, there are different schools, and there are some schools which say, well, there is something, but it's not really there. It's very vague. What Buddha taught was very simple, actually. His teachings are simple, but then if you want to explain it, it seems Buddha himself didn't want to explain it. He just this is the way it is, and just go with it. But he also said to preach it. See, I said I wasn't going to get into Buddhism, but there we go. He also said to preach it. But then when you preach it, then people bring objections, and then you have to establish a philosophy. And there's so many different schools within Buddhism. It's hard to understand. They have all these bodhisattvas, or almost Buddhas, or they're just stopping themselves from becoming a Buddha so they can do good to others. But they're doing good to others who are entangled in samsara, but actually they themselves don't exist, and samsara doesn't exist, and the people they're compassionate upon, they also don't exist. So it's really... It's really hard to work out. And then you come to things like the sound of one hand clapping, and then then you get Satori. And people take it very seriously, very, very serious about it. But it really confuses the intelligence. And then you got Mayavad on top of that, which is the same kind of idea, but they try to justify it on the basis of the Vedas. And that also, Mayavada Masatchastram Prachandam Buddha Muchete, is a Lord Shiva, also very powerful by following the Vedic process. The Mayavadis are very strong, and their influence is very strong, and they're backed up by Lord Shiva. Very powerful. And people believe and they feel they can become God. Absurd. Completely mad. How can you be? The idea of becoming God is so stupid. I don't know. Is there any word for it? Yeah, it's called Mayavad. That's the word. It's just unbelievably stupid, but it's backed up by a huge body of philosophy, and it's very hard to argue with them. It's very tough to argue, even with the Western Mayavad itself is an imagination, but then you get real Mayavadis in India who actually follow something and study and know something about it. But then you get the imagined New Age types in the West, and they're imagining some imagination. It's already an imagination, and there's just this feeling that we're all God, and you can't say anything to them because they're just in. It's an amazing feat of illusion. It's like someone bringing a whole crowd of people and at a distance seeing the Statue of Liberty in New York, and then boom, makes it vanish. He makes the Statue of Liberty vanish. There's a magician who did that. You know that? David Copperfield was his name, which is the same name as a figure in Dickens, some story. So he makes it vanish. And it's amazing, and it looks real, but it's just a big illusion. So it's the power of Lord Vishnu is able to confuse them in such a way that they completely lose any track of the Vedas, and then they become weak. Now Buddhism, I'm saying, it's very strong. That's by the power of Lord Vishnu, but in terms of any spiritual understanding, they're completely bereft of it because they don't believe there's any spirit anyway. From the very beginning, the whole discussion, practically you can say how we have the Uttara Mimamsa. We're talking about the Mimamsakas, the ones who follow the Karmakanda. And the Uttara Mimamsa, Vedanta Sutras, Vaishnavas, and Mayavadis, they accept the authorities of the Vedanta Sutras, which is based on the understanding that we are Atma. So there's a huge divide between the Mayavadis and the Vaishnavas on the understanding of what is the nature of the Atma. But it's not there with the Buddhists, because from the very beginning there is no Atma. It's anatma. The word is that there's no Atma. Then who's getting reincarnated? Who's suffering? Who's getting Nirvana? What is the nature of Nirvana? It's considered sacrilegious in Buddhism to even discuss the nature of Nirvana, because they just get stuck. There's nothing you could say about it. But it deviates them from the Vedic path. So they're really, really far away. And I appreciated that in the time I spent in Thailand and trying to preach there. And although people are very nice, most of the time. But to preach anything to them, it's really, really tough. The first time I read in Lord Chaitanya in Five Features, that was the chapter 7 of the Adi Leela with Srila Prabhupada, in all his publication of Chaitanya Charitamrita, the first thing he did was he did teachings of Lord Chaitanya first, a summary of the important conversations, or the principal conversations in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Then, when he was going to bring out the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita and the way that he had brought out Srimad Bhagavatam with verses, word-by-word translation, verse translation, commentary, he brought out, first of all, the Adi Leela of Chapter 7 as a booklet. And because that addresses Mayavad, and he wanted that distributed to all the big Mayavadis in India. He wanted that given to them. So I read in there that factually there's a discussion of the Mayavadis of Varanasi and the Buddhists of Sarnath, which is close to Varanasi. Generally we think of Buddhists at Gaya, but they have their big place in Sarnath also. So Srila Prabhupada wrote that factually both the Mayavadis of Varanasi and the Buddhists of Sarnath, they're gross materialists. And I couldn't get that. But they don't seem to be. They seem to be quite detached from the world. But their philosophy leads to that. And I really understood that when I went to spend some time trying to preach in Thailand, which is a fully Buddhist country, apart from a few Muslims running around in the jungles killing people in southern Thailand. But otherwise, Thai means Buddhist. The Christians made zero inroads there. Now, you'd think being Buddhists, they'd be like detached from the world. Nothing, no such thing. They're very sensual people. That's why people from all over the world like to go to Thailand for sex. You can get sex anywhere in the world, but in Thailand you get women, children, anything you like, and it's cheap. And they're nice to you. Maybe the prostitutes in other places are not so nice. I've heard from one of my godbrothers. I won't say who. He's come out of that now. But why are they so sensual when they're Buddhists? You'd think it'd be just the opposite. Well, I worked it out. I was speaking to one Buddhist woman once. I learned a little Thai, which I forgot except for a few words. Now, the most important word in the Thai language is sanuk, which means fun. And all the business in Thailand is run by the Chinese. The Thais themselves, they're not interested in working hard, stress. And they get a little money and they have sanuk, which means they sit around, eat noodles and fish and all kinds of abominable things they eat. It's Chinese culture, after all. And it's Indochina, right? It's influence of India is there, and influence of China is there also. And they have sex. And they laugh. And they're not serious about anything much. And it's a hot country, you don't have to work very hard. Traditionally, food you can grow easily, and there are fish in the rivers and pigs running around. They like to eat pigs especially, like I say, Chinese culture. They eat all kinds of things, but pigs is the staple, pork. Ugh. And all live grasshoppers, which are roasted alive in the oil on the street. And It's a delicacy, crispy, crunchy. All kinds of stinks like anything. Really bad. So anyway, I asked this woman that, okay, now you're eating, you like to eat pork, don't you? Yeah, of course. And don't you know that you'll become a pig in your next life for that? He said, yeah. He said, aren't you, doesn't that bother you? He said, no, that will also be Sanuk. They have a little philosophy. That much philosophy. Now, what I understood from this is that in Buddhism, the aim is to, it's not very much defined, they say nirvana, but it means the cessation of birth and death. But there's no bliss dancing with Krishna or stealing Krishna's laddus in the spiritual world. You see, I said I wasn't going to talk about Buddhism, and here I go. So, there's no bliss. It's just like being a light, just like they're saying in nirvana means literally no more, what is that, no more, what is that, Deepa Nivata Sto, Ningate Sopama Smita, the light in a windless place, and if the wind comes, it blows it out. So it's like the lamp going out, and so you just stop, you just don't exist. And what do you have to do that? Do you have to like perform all these terrible austerities and everything? So you might as well think, well, the goal is not very relishable, the way to attain it is not very relishable, so you might as well have Sanuk. Look on the bright side. Birth and death is miserable, yeah, but you can eat pigs. Become a pig, yeah, that will also be Sanuk. So there you go. The goal is so non-relishable and the way to attain it is also so miserable, then why would you want to do it at all? Whereas Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Paramakaranapanda, Kevala Ananda Kanda. The goal is highly relishable and the means of attaining it is highly relishable, and even from the very beginning it's blissful. But it's very hard to get through to the Buddhists because they're really locked in that consciousness that we are Buddhist, and it's very much, it's the Thai identity. And in Sri Lanka, also among the Sinhalese, are very few converted to Christianity. But hardly the Christians, they're mostly they're the Dutch burghers and all that, they're all mixed up. And the Muslims are Tamils, but the Sinhalese means Buddhist, and it's their identity. And Thai means Buddhist. There are Thai citizens who are Muslims, but the rest of the population don't consider them to be Thais. They say, if you ask, is he a Muslim? No, he's a Thai. Because Thai means Buddhist. So it's very deeply in their whole sense of who they are, self-identity, very deeply embedded. And preaching Krishna consciousness there, very, very difficult. Same in Japan. The Buddhist influence, it's like they're hermetically sealed from anything for their real benefit. So it really takes them away from the right path. But the strange thing is that it's so, in so many ways so close to the right path, because they also talk about Dhamma, Dharma. The culture is very similar. They have gurus. Practically in traditional Buddhism, their whole understanding of the universe is completely Puranic, the cosmology. And then when you go to hell, and who's there in hell? Yama in Thai, he's called Payom. Pa means Sri, just like in Tamil they have Tiru. So in Thai it's Payom. Yom means Yamaraj, and they have Pakasana means Sri Krishna. Pabisano means Vishnu. Pa In means Indra, and it's the same. you'll see, just like we see in temples in India, all the seven layers, the upper planetary, it's all taken from the Vedic culture. But it's just adjusted in such a way that they miss the whole point of everything. They're bewildered. So how has this come to Durariha? Because those who are enemies of the Vedic culture within it are removed from it. And Buddhists will never identify themselves, at least the traditional ones, will never identify themselves, that although the Hindus, they want to include the Buddhists in their ranks, but the Buddhists don't want to be included with the Hindus. Although in Bangladesh, it's funny, they have the Hindus, Buddhists and Christians. They're all together because they're all trying to get relief from the Muslims. But otherwise, here in India, the Buddhists, they identify themselves, they're very strongly different. They don't want to follow the Vedas. It's all mixed up because in Sri Lanka, they maybe because they're geographically separated, so they know that Buddha is considered Vishnu avatar. So if we go there and say we're devotees of Vishnu, they feel happy with that. So we have a little entry there in Sri Lanka, but they don't like the Hindus there at all. And that's exacerbated. Anyway, it's all very complex and it's all mixed up with very deeply mixed up with the bodily concept of life. But it is a fact that there are deceitful incarnations who deliberately mislead the demons. We're talking about Bali Maharaj and how they became very strong. How did that thing get resolved ultimately with Mohini Murti? It's a whole long story how the demons and the Indra, he insults his guru, and then he becomes banished. Brihaspati vanishes, Indra loses all his strength, the demons take advantage by following the Vedic process, march into the heavenly planets. They don't really conquer over it because the demigods all just run away. They know they don't have any chance because they lost their power because they don't have the backing of the brahmanas. And then Bali Maharaj is thrown down to the lower planets and then the demons regroup again. And then there's the churning of the milk, the nectar and the churning of the milk ocean is ultimately resolved by Mohini Murti bewildering the demons. They're as powerful as the demigods. If the demigods don't stay in line and properly worship Vishnu, then they're in trouble. And then they go to him again and again and again, asking for his help because they don't properly follow him and they lose their strength by not properly following the Vedic process. So this name Durarihara is also related to Parashurabhata, also links that to Mohini Murti and to these bewildering forms of Vishnu, these two especially. And even the Vedas themselves, there are statements which need not be misunderstood, but they are misunderstood. And then there are, in the Puranas, there are all kinds of things which are meant to appeal to people who are in the consciousness of trying to enjoy this world by worshipping the demigods. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, yo yo yang yang tanang bhaktasya, what is that? Shatayacharam ichati tasya tasyachalang shadham tameva vidyadham yaham. The people who worship demigods, I make their faith very strong in that. And one of the ways he does it is by having all these Puranas with stories just like showing how Shiva is superior to Vishnu, There may be some truth in it, as the Puranas are there, but it all has to be understood in the light of Srimad Bhagavatam. There may be some outward appearance like that. But just like Krishna, he shows himself inferior to Mother Yashoda. Ontologically, he's not. As a matter of love, he is. He's in some ways appearing inferior to Lord Shiva, but that's not on the same basis as his appearing inferior to Mother Yashoda. That's to Sammohaya Sura Dvisha. That's the same principle as Lord Buddha bewildering the atheists. But it's not exactly the same, because in this case they are within the Vedic culture, the worshippers of Lord Shiva. Even though they may be demons, they're also within the Vedic culture. But when they get too demoniac, then you may have to divert them away from the Vedic culture altogether. And then they become weak, and then they can be conquered. So it's all quite a subtle organization. People often have difficulty with this, especially when they first come to Krishna consciousness. They say, how can Lord Buddha be an avatar of Vishnu when he preaches against the Vedas? And it's generally considered by mundane scholars and probably by Buddhists also that the Hindus attempted to accommodate Buddhism within Hinduism by writing some backdated accounts of how Lord Buddha was a Vishnu avatar. Just like they say the Bhagavatam must come after Lord Buddha because it predicts him. Wait a minute, that's round the wrong way, isn't it? That means it should be before him, but they say no, it must come after him, because they couldn't predict it, could they? Because how could you predict something in future? We don't know how to do that, so Vyasa doesn't know how to do that. That makes sense, right? If Vyasa ever existed, probably there was no person as Vyasa ever existed. It's just some imaginations, and all the Vedic things, they're all written by different people. And it becomes more confused because you do have quite a lot of Puranas which were written fairly recently, and they're called Puranas, but they're not part of the Puranas which Vyasa had published, if you like, at the Sandhya. Now it's Sandhya of the day, but the Sandhya of Dwarapara and Kali Yuga. So later many, many works were written with the name Purana, but they're not Puranas of Vyasadeva. They're not part of the Vedic corpus. So they say like that. Well, you see, it says Buddha, and they pretend that it's predicted in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and in this way they want to re-blend Buddhism back into Hinduism, something like this, some idea like this. So it's quite a tangle to unsort all this stuff. Someone could spend their whole life studying the Sanskrit texts and the Pali texts and trying to sort it all out. And it is one of the great important pending tasks for scholars in Krishna consciousness, or even more broadly, the Vedic scholars, to disprove all these allegations. Although unfortunately, most of the people who consider themselves to be Vedic scholars, or scholars of Hinduism and pro-Hindu, but they all say, oh, the Puranas, that's all allegorical. They don't accept it as story. They don't accept it as fact. So that's another major obstacle, that they've surrendered to the Western rationalistic, or maybe not even Western, because Westerners weren't the first people to doubt the Vedas, but they've surrendered to this dominant mindset, which it is coming from the West for the last 200 years or so, that we can't believe stories like this, just a Matsya avatar, a little fish is talking to someone and then grows bigger and bigger and bigger till it becomes as big as the whole universe practically. And obviously it's nonsense, right? It's like fairy stories made up by people who didn't know science. And mostly nowadays the scholars who are trying to show that, yeah, Hinduism is a good religion, and they're trying to combat all these things. They say, no, it's allegorical. And then they'll all be, these are mostly Mayavadis. They, not real Mayavadis, but they don't really know what Mayavad is or anything, but they have this vague idea that we're all one. Again, the all-pervading wrong idea. So yeah, it is difficult to understand how the Supreme Lord spreads anti-Vedic religion for the purpose of making the Vedic religion stronger. It's something like culling. There's a word, culling. When there's a population, say that was done in Africa a few decades ago, the 40,000 elephants were killed because they thought that would make the, we'll kill all the weak ones and that will leave the stronger ones. And then afterwards, the great scientist who recommended it afterwards had second thoughts and thought, actually, I made a mistake. 40,000 elephants dead later. So the idea of culling, you reduce the population because there's not enough food for all of them, so you should just, or pruning a tree, that works, if you know how to do it properly, to make it come back stronger. So that idea is there, that when there are very detrimental influences within the Vedic, the Vedas are being misused, just take them outside altogether. But then that, again, take them outside the Vedic culture. But it requires someone very powerful to be able to do that. And so Lord Vishnu comes. And then to bring them back in again, because the animal killing has stopped. But now you've got this horrible idea, which is very impractical and very dangerous, actually, for human society. Destroys Varnashram. Buddhists are very much against Varnashram. So to build it up gradually, then Shankara comes. And he's Lord Shiva. He's also very powerful. He says, within this material world, he acts as powerfully as Lord Vishnu in many ways. So then we say Shiva and Vishnu are the same. Well, that's true to a large extent, maybe even more so within the material world, because Vishnu is a bit aloof from it all. But Shiva, he's overseeing the material energy, who is his wife. So he's very, very powerful in this world. So he comes and he reestablishes the veracity of the Vedas. And it's all quite complex because I mean, I'm only saying a few things, but if you really want to get into it in depth, you could spend your whole life, but it doesn't really matter that much because it's all history. And now those arguments, like the Shankara, he was actually debating more with Mimamsakas than, we don't find him debating with Buddhists, hardly. Madhva did later on. So Buddhism was still strong. It's a whole complex history, and it's difficult to sort out and what's all going on. But in another sense, it doesn't really matter that much. If you're preaching in Salem, it doesn't really matter much about Buddhism, because are there any Buddhists in Salem? Any Tibetans arrived here, or Sikkimese? There may be one or two here or there. Every middle class Hindu has a statue of Buddha in his house, isn't it? Pretty much, it's very popular to have, for some reason or other. But they're not Buddhists; they're Hindus. So it's not really that much of an issue. And you have people like our Dr. Ramesh, the doctor, the dentist, they're impressed by. I guess he reads things like the Tao of Physics by Fritjof Capra and other books like that, in which they try to show that Buddhism fits with quantum theory, and they become very impressed by all of that. And within the movements of the electrons, within the subatomic particles, within the atom, it's just like the dance of Shiva, and they become very impressive. Yeah. Maybe it is, I don't know, but it doesn't really matter in your day-to-day preaching, does it? You want to sell people Prabhupada's books, and then that's it. It just cuts through all that stuff anyway. But it's not much of an issue here. But if you go to the West, actually, this Neo-Buddhism is quite influential. And even you'll find all these vegans, a lot of them, they consider themselves to be Buddhists. Although the Dalai Lama, who's the main propagator or is considered the biggest Buddhist in the world, he's not a vegetarian, nothing like a vegan. He's the antithesis of a vegan. He eats a lot of meat. And then if you say Dalai Lama in Sri Lanka, they won't give you the time of day. They don't like him at all because Dalai Lama is Mahayana and they're Theravada. But it doesn't matter here. It doesn't matter here at all. But the influence is there in other places. And of course, Dr. Ambedkar made a political statement, not a religious statement. I lost the sound. Dr. Ambedkar made a political statement, not really a religious statement. It was a social come political statement that he identified himself as a Buddhist. It wasn't that he was convinced of Buddhist philosophy or any such thing. So it's all very complex. But then, Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam, Bhagavad Gita. In some ways, it's maybe better not to get into all these complexities, because it's really Shabda Jala Maharanyam Kevala Chitta Brahmanam. There's a great forest of a network of words which simply makes the mind spin round and round. Who said those words? Shankaracharya. So, just forget all this nonsense and surrender to Krishna. But for people who are influenced by that, it becomes very, very tough to say anything sensible to them whatsoever. And if they try to talk to you and you point out, which isn't very difficult to point out, that they're talking all nonsense, then they'll say, words, words, it's all just words. As long as you agree with them, the words are okay. But when you point out that they're talking nonsense, then they just, it's all words. Everything is beyond words. So it is tough. The influence of Buddha is going on. And yeah, it should be done. All kinds of misconceptions should be destroyed at the root. But that requires some specialized. There's so many specialized things required to be done. And not immediately. Immediately we need to make the Krishna consciousness movement strong. It's not very strong in the world, but as it becomes stronger, we can expect more attacks from Mayavadis, maybe from Tattvavadis and Radha Kunda Babaji's and the gross materialists and all kinds. Srila Prabhupada, he wanted the Bhaktivedanta Institute for establishing Krishna consciousness on among not just the scientific, also the intellectual community. So it's a great task. It's a very tough task, and there are so many facets. But here we're just discussing how the Lord takes the form of Buddha and other forms to mislead people. Seems very strange, doesn't it? Most of the avatars, they were Krishna speaks Bhagavad Gita, Rama gives the ideal example, Hayagriva, Matsya, they give the Vedas, restoring the Vedas. Vamana also misled Pali Maharaj. So these things, but in this way, they in this way, Durariha can mean he who destroys the difficult enemies, and that can refer to various avatars. But especially this is being explained by Parashar Bhatta in terms of Buddha avatar. Another way this can be understood is that what are the enemies? The Shara Ripu, the six enemies, Kam, Krodh, Lobh, Moha, Mada, Matsarya. These are the real enemies within our hearts. Lust, greed, anger, illusion, pride, and envy. They're very difficult to remove. But he, being very kind, Lord Vishnu helps his devotees to remove the negative aspects in our mind when we resort to him, the demoniac tendencies that we have. This is understanding is given by Baladev Vidya Bhushan. It's very difficult to destroy all these enemies, but he can do so. He helps us. Mameva ye prapadyante mayam etam tarantite. We are Bhaktivinoda Thakur praise Gopinath, kabe ba jagibo ame, kama rupa are dure teagibo hridaye shvuribe tumi. He's praying to Gopinath that when will I wake up and the enemy of lust, kama rupa ari, here we have dur ari ha, I'll leave it far, long way behind, and then you will manifest within my heart. So this meaning is given by Baladev Vidyabhushan and also Satyadeva Vashishta, who also, Satyadeva Vashishta, he links this name, Durariha, with the Brahma Gayatri Mantra, that by chanting the Brahma Gayatri, that the sun rising, the sun cleans the heart by worshipping Lord Vishnu in the sun, or the sun as Lord Vishnu, that cleans the heart. And of course, we know very well, Chaito Darpana Marjanam, this cleansing of the heart. Krishna himself personally helps to cleanse the heart. And then again we have Shrinvatam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Hridyantasto Hiyabhadrani Vidhunoti Suhritsatam. Krishna, as the best well-wisher of the devotees, helps to clean the heart of all the dirty things of those who like to hear about him. And hearing about him is described Punya Shravana Kirtana. It's very pious to hear about him and chant about him, very purifying. And that's one of the names still to come in Vishnu Sahasranam. That's one of the names of Vishnu. Punya Shravana Kirtana. It's of whom hearing about and chanting about is in itself pious. What you might call the simple and obvious meaning is that he kills all the demons. That's also one of the meanings given by the interpreters, but that's come up in various ways already, and so they're giving other understandings. This understanding is given from the Madhva Sampradaya. Of course, they always like demon killing interpretations. So that's Yeah, you'll find that in most of the names, they'll have something which, they'll find some way to interpret it as killing all the demons. In many of the names, they'll find like that. So yeah, he kills all the demons. But for the good people, the Vaishnavas, or the sattvic people, or those who follow the Vedic culture without duplicity, he is he's always trying to uplift them. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashayata dushkritam. Hare Krishna. Durariha ki jai. Vancha kalpatarubhyascha kripa sindhubhya evacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Dante nidhaya charnakam padayo nipatya kritva chaka kushatameta daham bravimi he sadhava sakala eva vihaya durat goranga chandra charane kuru tanurana parivadatu jano yata tatava nanumukaro navayam vicharayama hari rasa madira madati mata bhuvi vilutama nata. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.